This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
The first sentence of that story goes, I've got 38 aunts called Comfort and all of them are assholes. So, yes.
Hi, everybody. I'm Donnie Walton.
And I'm Deesha Filioff.
And this is the IRSA podcast, where we geek out on all things short fiction. On this podcast, we'll interview authors like today's illustrious guest, Nana Nkweti. We'll discuss collections and stories we love and shine a light on new writers and those who never got their due.
But we're not just talk. We're publishers, too. Over at ursastory.com, we've created a new home for short fiction from some of today's most thrilling writers, as well as emerging voices, with stories you can read on your phone and audio stories that you can listen to right here in your favorite podcast app. We're doing all of this with support from you. Become an IRSA member today by subscribing in Apple Podcasts or by going to ursastory.com/join.
And like I mentioned today, we are talking to Nana Nkweti, the author of Walking on Cowrie Shells. Now, I'm going to give a little bio information on Nana, but then we're going to like get real loose and tell a story about what happened when all three of us met up in Miami. Okay, so first of all, let me say, Nana, I love your Twitter bio. First of all, so I have to read that first. Comerican, cultural carnivore, professor and professional pro slanger.
Mm-hmm. Say it with some basic slanger.
I love it. Slanger.
Yes. So now, okay, now I'm gonna do the buttoned up version. Okay. Nana Nkweti is a Cameroonian American writer and AKO Kane Prize finalist whose work has garnered fellowships from McDowell, Vermont Studio Center, UCross, and many, many others. Her first book, Walking on Cowrie Shells, was hailed by the New York Times, by Deesha Filioff, in fact, as a raucous and thoroughly impressive debut with stories to get lost in again and again. Her work features elements of mystery, horror, myth, and graphic novels to showcase the complexity and vibrance of African diaspora cultures and identities. She's a professor of English at the University of Alabama, where she teaches creative writing courses that explore her eclectic literary interests. Nana, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Donnie. Thank you, Deesha. I'm so appreciative to be here.
We are happy to be talking with you again after, as Donnie said, our fun time meeting you in Miami.
So let's paint the picture, right?
Uh-oh.
It is.
I thought what happened in Miami stayed in Miami. Oh.
What had happened was.
It's all love here. It's all love here. So it is late November. It is a precious window of time between when the Delta variant eases and Omicron came and put its foot on our necks, right? So that's where we're at. It is cold in New York City. It is cold in Pittsburgh. We are looking forward to some warmth, some heat, beaches. We get to Miami. We're excited to meet each other. It rains almost the entire damn time it rains, right? And so there's a big party that everyone's excited to go to. It's going to be at the, was it the Standard? The rooftop on the Standard. We all packed our cute clothes. We're excited. It's still raining. So it was me and you and Dantiel Moniz and Brian Broom, the Kirkus winner for Punch Me Up to the Gods. Mm-hmm. It was Shayla Seabury, the poet. It was Black excellence. Yes. It was incredible, incredible. And we are all so excited because Nana Nkweti is coming, right? And
in the house.
In the house. We're crowded under. Yes. We are crowded under this awning, right? Because it is pouring outside and we're trying to stay dry. And Nana comes through with her family and they are dressed to the gods.
To the nines. I mean,
they are.
Faces beat.
So Nana sits with us. We're talking about all things lit world. We're kikiing, we're laughing, we're feeling like kings and queens because, like, this is our night. Nana's family has gone inside. They're getting their drinks. They're actually, like, having, like, a party, a good time. Mm-hmm. When they come back out, you know, Nana says, oh, you know, to her sister, can we take a picture? Can you take a group picture of us? And so we're huddled up and we're trying to get ourselves together and get our poses and everything. And she's taking the picture and changing the lighting and everything. And I think, Nana, at some point you said something to your sister, you know, come on, you're like, finish taking the picture. And your sister said, I'm sorry, I'm not used to hanging out with book nerds like y'all. Mm-hmm. And we fell out. Mm-hmm. We fell out. And
we
not
were
only
like
I
the
tell
cool
you,
kids, but then
she burst, listen, she
Bubbles
busted that
burst.
Bubble. She was like, and let me tell you, I fell in love with you then. I fell in love with your family because it was just, it felt so real and so warm. And I was like, I felt like I knew you a little bit more than any bio could say. So we are so happy to have you here.
First of all, Dolly, let me say that the way you tell the story, I was like, what happened next? You had me riveted. And I was there. I was like, ooh. I'm like, ooh, no, they did not.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, now let's get into our little conversation. Your collection is absolutely stunning.
Oh,
and
thank
so
you.
Eclectic and had me laughing, had me thinking. I am just curious about the journey of this collection, you know, from writing it to finding the right publishing home for it, all of that good stuff.
Well, you know, the journeys are long and, you know, sometimes the road is rocky, but you have to do it. I mean, I think that the real journey is from Nana and Kweti, age 9, writing little sci-fi / you know, Jane Austen mashups, you know. And that was very much my trajectory. It was like a blue stocking young woman who was just really introverted. And most of my besties were in books and that I always knew that I was going to write stories. So that that, like, you know, fast forward many, many, many years and me finally privileging that writing self and allowing for myself to kind of put my voice in the world. That's the journey, right? You know, you go to school, you're a good daughter of immigrants, so you're going to go to law school, you're going to get the safe job. But then finally making sure that my family was okay, that these very fancy folks you were talking about, you know, had all gone through school and were educated, and then finally going back and saying, hey, what about that book I've always wanted to write? What about that book that I have in me? It's my time now, you know?
That's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
And you kick off the collection with a lovely and very specific dedication to your parents. And so in what ways did your family contribute to the spirit and wisdom of this collection?
I mean, my family, as you know, as Donnie's anecdote, you know, reveal, we're incredibly close-knit. We are very, they're very, very interested in the world. They've got ranges of people. And it's just like being in that place where you had a family that allows for you to be all your multiple selves, to be Whitman-esque and contain those multitudes, it was wonderful. I grew up in a house with my father and my mother always having books around us. We always had a library, a space where, you know, that was kind of privileged. It was like a kind of like the holy of holies, you know. So I was reading books from a very young age that might have been way too much, too inappropriate for my young, tender years. But, you know, I was like, it was just a wonderful kind of like inculcation and introduction to reading and just reading books, you know, with literature with a capital L to, you know, my brother actually like read the encyclopedia from A to Z when he was young. So that's the kind of family, you know, family I grew up in. We're just really privileged, reading and that kind of space for the imagination. So yeah, that's my family. And my mom's and pops, you know, I knew that, it, you know, that book was going to be dedicated to the very beginning, because I knew that, like, they were the blueprint for, you know, for that.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Love talking about point of view. I mean, you and I both went to Iowa. We talk about point of view all the time. And I disagreed with a lot of our professors about what they had to say about point of view. But what I want to say is that I really enjoyed the stories in the collection that offered, if even for a paragraph or two, another voice or another perspective. I mean, I'm thinking about Night Becomes Us, where we get not only Zainab's perspective, but for that one short section, those couple paragraphs, the perspective of the teenage suicide bomber who kills her mother. Or in The Devil is a Liar, you're alternating between the perspectives of Temperance and Glory, her mother. How do you know when a story is calling for a dip into another point of view? Is that a decision that you make from the start, or is it something that evolves as you're writing?
I mean, I think it changes from story to story. I knew that in The Devil is a Liar, I was going to be telling these like dual perspectives, because this conversation and this relationship between the mother and daughter, Temperance and Glory, was central to their narrative. Like, how would they navigate their generation gap and their kind of levels of spirituality and come to a place of understanding? So I knew I would kind of be moving between the two of them, like a dance, with that suicide bomber, like telling Hanifa's perspective in Night Become Us. I was very much aware that I didn't want her to be vilified. I didn't want her to become a place like, you know, either this tragic figure or this, or like the person who, like, you know, was just like a kind of soulless killer. I wanted us to understand why she was in that space at that kind of climactic moment. So it just kind of, intuitively, I just knew I had to kind of enter her space. And you are correct. Sometimes, like, you know, those craft classes, they tell us, oh, we can't do that kind of head hopping. You can't switch POVs like mid, you know, story like that. That's like, you know, verboten. And there's all these kind of huge, like, you know, do not enter signs around certain choices. And you just have to kind of go with your gut and take that kind of narrative leap and see if that your readers can go with you. So I'm glad it landed for people, and that it didn't feel dissonant, and that people, you know, kind of that space at that time allowed her humanity to be shown, even though she was soon gone from the page and from that world.
And, you know, this idea of doing what you want to do, you know, and this, the boldness, it just comes through the entire collection. And even in some non-text ways, right? So you have included illustrations, photos, and graphics in some of the stories, like Rain Check at MomoCon and Schoolyard Cannibal. And then even the diary font in Dance the Fire Dance that, you know, breaks up the narrative there. How did these elements become part of the collection?
I was very aware. The great thing about, like, you know, going through and having and doing this book later in life is that I had so much moxie. Like, I've always known that what I wanted to do and been very, like, you know, singular minded. But by the time, you know, there are zero F's to give. By the time, you know, you're like you're grown. You're just like, and this is how we're going to do this, you know. And you get to, you know, you're used to honor your own choices, and you just want to have your say. I was like, if I'm going to be doing this book, I wanted to be Gonzo. I wanted to do all the things that I needed to do on the page. I knew that, you know, I can't be, especially like we're talking about moments of Ekphraxis and like the graphic novel. I'm doing a whole story at Comic-Con. Of course, there's going to be a graphic element. Of course, there's got to be a comic book page. If I could, like, you know, have a whole anime, you know, technology does not exist, but one day if I could have like video popping up from that book, I would have had the, you know, the cartoon animation going. I knew I was going to do that. I knew that I was going, you know, when I was looking at fonts and they sent me initial drafts and it didn't have that kind of humanist handwriting font, I was like, okay, no, we have to go back and do this and I just researched fonts even in my early, non-production valued way, I was adding those elements and they were just integral to the understanding of the story, because that's what our world looks like. We're, all of our senses are stimulated. We see, we smell, we taste, we hear, So if I could add, have music lyrics in there and with references to music, references to food, and have those visuals, which are very much part of the graphic world and very much part of schoolyard canon, which is bannable, which is interrogating the use of images to make certain people feel small, I'm going to do that, Mm. So
you actually used a word that I have seen a lot, but I don't know what it means. What is ekphrasis, you said?
Yes, yes. That's basically just having the use of more formally when people were going to, let's say you're going to a museum and you're writing a poem in response to a piece that you see, and then maybe that moment you're literally kind of doing a one-to-one ratio representation of that particular art form, but now in narrative form, right? But for this I'm just referencing any moment where the image often came first, right? Any moment where I'm in where my text is in conversation with visual elements. So yeah,
I love that, and I also find that I'm doing that as well when I'm writing. If I'm, when I was researching Opal and Nev, looking at photography,
absolutely,
that really inspired,
absolutely,
things that happen, and there's a sort of symbiosis between, a song and an image and all of that. And this segues very well into my next question, which, there's a lot of playfulness in your work, mm-hmm, with form, with humor, and with the pop culture references, which I love. And so I always love when I feel like the writer is having fun on the page. And I wondered, which story did you have the most fun writing? When you were sitting typing and you were sort of making yourself laugh or anything like that?
It's so interesting. So many people have referred to the humor in all of the pieces, even in the most dark and somebody was saying I go from the comedic to profound. I don't realize that because that's who I am naturally. I've got a kind of dry, snarky humor, mm-hmm. I come from a family that loves to laugh. So once again, that idea of containing the multitudes, if I want the narratives to reflect all the kind of, facets of the human condition, humor is one of them, right? So sexy times is one of them. So there's sexy moments and there's fun moments and there's moments of horror and pain and pathos. I just want that full, evolution or that full movement through all those type of ranges and registers of expression. So making me laugh out loud, I would say, I don't want to say her name because she who shall not be named in It Takes a Village to Come Say, their girl, the protagonist in that, she was just very, she has so much moxie. I say that she's got the disposition of an Uzi because she comes there not unapologetic. She's like, and you best believe, that's her energy. She's got that kind of rah-rah girl energy that, you're just like, wow. Are we doing that out here? Really? Really? So I would say she had me in shock, do a couple of shock chuckles, every once in a while, So it's only afterwards really that I realized that sometimes that humor comes through, but because it's so natural to who I am as a writer, I'm not, mm-hmm, always thinking it when I'm doing it, but somebody will tell me, oh, that had me laugh out loud. And I was like, oh, okay, I see. I can see that,
And actually, It Takes a Village, Some Say, was one of my favorites, mm-hmm, in the collection. I mean, mm-hmm, I loved every single story, but if I had to choose some favorites, that was definitely one, mm-hmm, of mine. It's satirical. I am a sucker for satire. Mm-hmm. And as I noted in my review in the Times, this particular story is set against the backdrop of social media celebrity culture. Mm-hmm. And we witness this, unlikely collision of fandom, which is financial domination kink for you vanilla folks out there.
And I have to say, I must be vanilla because I did not. I was like, oh, I'm learning something today. Okay.
don't ask me how I know.
tell it. So, is this that kind of podcast?
Yes, it is. It is. We go there.
I love
it.
So
So you pull together Findom and the murky business of international adoption. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite lines is when the white adoptive mother of this Cameroonian child observes, "People think Bono and Bill Gates are supporting the continent. They have no idea it's us." Listen, the way I cackle, I could hear that white woman saying that line. Mm. Like, and that's the thing about like so much. We were talking about this in our last episode. Mm. Like in these days, satire, you know, runs real close in speculative fiction because the world and the state that it is, it just feels kind of real sometimes. You know, it feels a lot, you know, very realistic. You're like, yeah, this is satire, but it's real close. Mm-hmm. And I just love how throughout the collection, there are moments where you bring irreverence and nuance to some sensitive subjects, including the tensions between Africans and Black Americans, as you do, for example, in Dance to Fire Dance. Mm. You also take that up again with a lot of tenderness in Schoolyard Cannibal, where we meet a Black girl of Cameroonian descent who is mistreated by her Black American peers. And as I was reading, I was like, ooh, this story can go a lot of different directions. Mm. What were some of your considerations as you were crafting Schoolyard Cannibal?
I would say, first of all, like, you know, thank you for your comment on the satire, because I feel like, you know, we are living in this dystopian moment. Like, you know, and everything is just, truth is way stranger than fiction these days. Very much so. And like for Schoolyard Cannibal, I think, and with all my stories, like, you know, it was incredibly important for me that, like, you know, I just present stories and human beings and moments that feel as authentic as possible, that feel like real human beings, real concerns writ on the page, right? And that story, it was, honestly, it almost didn't make it in the book because it was something that was very tender to me. That was, it was a story I came and made my way to only after reading, you know, Claudia Rankine's Citizen, and having that kind of language and understanding the idea of, like, you know, of how to kind of tell tales of microaggression, tell tales of feeling lack, you know, in a society. And I almost didn't put it in there because, very much so, because I did not want it to be a space of, like, you know, perpetuating tensions between Africans and African Americans. I didn't want people to say, and you know, and just be like, and not see other perspectives. So when I'm writing this, those perspectives, as you can see, I kind of go between, like, you know, trying to understand, like, you know, why are those tensions there? You know, I'm writing into them and depicting them. I did not make them. I did not invent them. You know, they're things that I've seen in my life growing up, you know, moments where, you know, like African identity was very much, you know, not popular. Nobody wanted to be African. White folk didn't want to be African. Chinese and people didn't, and nobody wanted to be African. So, but that's like, you know, that's the kind of the story of, unfortunately, Black identity kind of writ large, right? You know, nobody wants the struggle and the pain. They only want, like, you know, when your things are on and popping and flossy, right? So, like, I did not want that to be out there. I honestly, at one point, I literally said this. I was like, to my white editor, I was like, I don't know if I want white folks to see this. You know, I don't want people in our business.
It's our dirty laundry.
Yeah. I don't know if I want them up in our business like this. You know, I want this something to be something that, you know, that, but I did want it to be something that sparked conversations. And if somebody can have a conversation and, like, you know, kind of bridge that gap, then let it be. Let it be doing that kind of work out in the world so that, like, you know, the next time you say something out of pocket to somebody about somebody who has a different, you know, heritage from you, you're just like, oh, why am I really saying this? Let's interrogate that. Have we now been pitted against each other with these kind of false dichotomies that don't really exist? You know, like, you think, okay, oh, African Americans have this it easy because they've had this, and you're feeling, or that Africans have it easy because they have this. I'm just like, who's really, like, running the, you know, the things, you know, and, like, what is it, what is gained from, like, you know, us being in kind of opposition like that? So so that was why I ended
who
up
benefits?
Writing
it. Who, it ain't us.
Does not. It does not benefit us. So I'm like, I literally grew up in that space, right? I grew up, like, you know, grew up in Southeast DC, and all my teachers were Black. So everybody was, like, you know, African American. And then I go to, you know, to Cameroon, West Africa, and that's the rest of my, you know, high school years spent there. So those Black spaces very much are inform who I am as a person. My identity is, you know, people who raised me up were from those two cultures. So every time I saw that kind of dissonance and that, like, you know, level of kind of pushing against each other. I was just like, but I am because you guys are. So I've never wanted that to be our portion, you know? So
Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, that was incredible. And it made me also think about, Disha, you mentioned this story as well as part of that question, Dance the Fire Dance, where you have the heroine who is, and correct me if I say this wrong, called Akata. Did I say it correctly?
You want to put a little twang in it like you did before. Akata. She's Akata.
Akata. Akata. Which, can you explain what that is to the listeners?
Yes. So she's African, her father is from Brooklyn, New York. He's African American. And then her mother is from Cameroon, West Africa. And Akata is, a nickname for African Americans. And that, I've seen that through West Africa. So I used to think, as everybody thinks it's one thing, those slangs only come from their culture. But it was initially, I believe it was kind of neutral in as an assignation. But then later on, I kept on hearing it so many times in words of derision, used with a little bit of the those Akata. So it was one of those things where I always found myself having to do this kind of ambassadorial duties. Like, really now? Is that what we're doing? And that moment, Catherine speak about, this is my background and you are here because my parents, Akatas did this for you to have a place in this country. That is something that those are conversations I've had. So,
Well, I fell out at this part because, you treat the subject with a lot of tenderness, yes, but also humor in the collection. And there's a moment where the protagonist of the story is at this wedding and she's caught the eye of Philip, who I think is sort of an eligible bachelor and he likes her very much. So he says to her, actually, my sister warned me about the dangers of American girls. His voice is whispery against the coil of my ear. He pulls me close. Did she now? I smile at him over my shoulder as I settle into him. I may be only half American, but I rub that half against him for all I'm worth. I said, okay, girl. Okay.
Yes.
I love
that. That was a moment. I love that. It
was a moment. So y'all like the sexy times, with your fandom knowledge that came out of nowhere.
Yes. Yes. Listen. I'm telling on myself today. Ain't no shame. Ain't no shame.
We love the sexiness. We love the juiciness. We love it all.
And once again, just part of the human existence and condition. Everything. I wanted everything to be in there. I wanted it to feel tender. I wanted it to feel raw. I wanted it to feel sexy when it needs to be sexy. And I wanted it to be satirical when it needs to be satirical. All just to kind of show the fullness of these characters.
And for the collection as a whole, looking back, what do you wish you could go back and say to pre-publication Nana about the process?
Oh my goodness, it's going to be all right. Sound like a rap song over here. I think that you feel it feels like a Herculean task just kind of getting a book to, just to an agent and then to an editor and a house that really gets behind your work. And then after that, there's a whole long period of editing and you don't even know when it's going to, when are you going to actually launch this book into the world? But once it's there, it's just like that mother who feels like she's been pregnant for 22 months. It's only been, you're just like, oh, thank you. It's going to be okay. And once you do it, especially because I'm a debut author, once you've done it, it just makes you feel like nothing is insurmountable. I can do this again and again and again. And I look forward to that process. So
that's awesome. How does a story typically start for you?
Oh, I'm very, very voice driven. So I call it almost being possessed or having somebody come and say, whisper in your ear and tell you the juiciest tale. And you kind of have to follow them because they're kind of walking off into the night. And you're just like, I don't know where they're taking me. That dark alley looks scary, but I want to hear the rest of this story. And that's what happens. I'm very voice driven. So these characters come to me, my first paragraphs are pretty much, they go unchanged because once I get that voice in my head, it's almost like they just immediately just sitting next to me and met at the smoky bar and they're walking me down the street and, we're going to have our time together. And they're just like, okay. And the moral of the story, and then they're just like, bye. And then it's interesting. So that's how it happens. I'm very, very voice driven.
That sounds thrilling. to be like led down or led into some cool place, or I love it. And then in terms of revision, how quickly do you sort of write your first draft? And then how many revisions do you typically do?
So it's interesting because my stories ended up going through the more formal review process, because like some of these stories were written for Iowa and written for a workshop environment. So you'd end up like at least getting one revision kind of cycle done with like people who were very interested in kind of like, you know, helping you grow as a writer. So the stories that I wrote outside of the workshop process, like, you know, I would say like I would do like one or maybe two, versions of them. But like the voices, you know, very much stay the same. The first paragraphs very much stay the same. I think what happens often, you know, like when you get to an editor and what have you, they have you do this kind of, you know, yes, sometimes you kill darlings, but often they're just asking me to kind of linger and stay in a moment and kind of like expand on, you know, a moment, a scene. Like, so that whole Findom section that you loved, Disha, it was not there initially, you know. It was... I was actually like, you know, like there's, I think a previous incarnation of this story was like published, and it was like that version had, you know, just, we just went from her talking about like, you know, feeling like she was not being seen in her American high school. And she, next thing you know, we hear about her, you know, her, that she's done certain things to get money. Like, you know, she's done her, like, the, you know, comely cleaners, like the worked, I think the semi-topless, nude, semi-nude cleaning service to get money. But I really like went back, you know, at the advice of my editor, and just kind of sat in that moment and like watched her process, like watch her kind of empire building, you know, to kind of get to her version of the American dream, because she's just like, by any means necessary, I'm going to be who I was meant to be. You know, if America is transactional in this way, I'm going to figure out how to game this system and not get played by it. So that I just spent more time expanding upon something that I might have just kind of mentioned in the first incarnation. So.
And I actually have a follow-up question to something you said. Question for any listeners out there who are readers, but maybe not writers. What is the difference between a story developed in workshop environment versus outside of it in your mind?
You know, it's interesting. I know people, there's a lot of kind of discussion about MFA or NYC, people who are kind of like issuing like, you know, workshop spaces and, you know, worried about that they kind of have like a kind of flattening effect and that writers won't get to be themselves. But I never experienced that, once again, like I said, because I was, by the time I was like, you know, really privileging my writing, I was pretty sure that what I had a voice, I knew what I wanted to say. And like, you know, and you learn it. Like, not everybody's necessarily going to be your ideal reader. You know, even that ideal reader might not be that person who's saying they love everything. You know, so that ideal reader that you want is that person who loves things, and they see possibilities and help you get where you need to go in terms of expanding as a writer and growing as a writer. So I felt very fortunate being in that kind of workshop experience. My stories that were done out of the side of workshop experience, I think that my main problem was like this idea of being, you know, I'm a good immigrant daughter. I have way too much like perfectionist tendencies. So sometimes I have to get out of my own way and allow things, let them go, and not say, oh, I'm just going to revise this again, you know, or like, let's put it out into the world. I think that being in those kind of spaces, mm-hmm. that privileged literature, it just makes you, you know, just do things faster, you know, just like, okay, because other people have given you that cosign and that dap, and you're just like, okay, I don't have to be afraid. Let me just go ahead and put this out in the world. You know, you see your colleagues mm-hmm. around you doing that, your peers around you doing that. They read your work, you know, and you're just like, okay, this is doable. You know, it makes the whole process feel like feasible, demystifies mm-hmm. it, you know.
I also have a process question for you. How do you know when a story is finished?
Oh, so this is going to sound so weird because, like I said, like, you know, my stories, like those stories where they're very voice driven. And like, I feel like it's like they're like summer love, you know, it's like how it's telling somebody, like, how do you know that fling is over? You know, it's like, how do you know? It's just, I feel like you have that wonderful time and you know that like that, you know, that it was a season, right? So that's typically what happens to me. Like, you know, I feel like my characters tell me that, you know, they literally go end scene and like, you know, they tell me all they have to tell me. And not, some people don't agree because some people, you know, be like, oh, no, this could be a whole novel. And I know in my gut, no, it couldn't. We were done. Mm. You know, that character has told me what they wanted me to tell tell me about their life. And then, like, you know, and then you just say farewell. And, you know, it's like, feels bittersweet. And, like, you love being in that world. You love being in that space. You, like, loved hearing them talk. But once they're done telling you their story, they're done, you know. And I think some people could benefit from that. Novelist.
Ooh, the shade.
Shade. Oh.
Oh. I'm sweating over here.
But you know how it is. Sometimes, you know, it's like, I feel like there's a compactness. Sometimes people go, like, they're just, like, they're going on longer than they, you know, when the party is done and, like, you know, like, everybody else has left and gone home and you ready to take your shoes off and they're still hanging around trying to have, a, you know. That's just a joke. I say that that's, I feel like that's one of the benefits. Like, for me, I've just intrinsically and instinctively known, like, okay, like, they're my, when my characters are done with me, they're done with me. Like, you know, I don't feel like I have to kind of to keep things going artificially, you know? So.
Yeah, I could use some of that. Mm. Like, I need a little bit more.
Oh my God, Donnie. Are you feeling?
No, I do.
Do not. I was not even talking about you. I'm just making fun.
No. But see, I feel like, I felt a little indicted,
oh my God.
You know, no, I'm kidding. No, but it's true. Like, when you're saying that you have a gut instinct mm-hmm. for when the party is over, mm-hmm. I don't really. Mm-hmm. Like, I keep, and I love short fiction. And one of the reasons why I love short fiction is because I find it very difficult to write short fiction because I don't know when the end is. And I often keep stuffing the world full of things and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger instead of kind of, you know, at a manageable scale where it can end. Mm. You know, I just keep opening new doors and threads. Mm. And I greatly admire the stories in this collection. And, like, I feel very satisfied when I reach the end of each one. And I think that has to do with your gut feeling for when the party is over.
Yeah. So, thank you. I'm so, you know, honestly, you know, I feel like that's a wonderful thing to say because I feel like, you know, I appreciate that, like, you know, where I landed allowed people to feel like something is expanded, they've gained something, even if they don't mm-hmm. have all the answers. I mean, that I feel like that reflects life, right? Like, I feel like we get to the end of a character's story, it's a short time with them, and they might not have everything figured out, but you can see they're a nod in that direction, or there's something that feels like, you know, there's a sense of closure for you, and that's all I want for readers to gain when they read.
I thought maybe we could, like, let's do a little bit of an inspirational moment and do a flashback to your first ever short fiction publication.
Mm.
I mean, I think we all write for a while before we even think about sending our work out and think about where we're going to place it. But, you know, just tell us the year and the publication and what the story was and what it was like to find out that it was going to be published.
Oh, this is a very what happened was, you know. So let me do some caveats, right? So there's, you know, there's the first time that my work was published. And then there's the first time where I was actually paid for my work being published. That felt like, oh, I have arrived. I'm grown now. I'm a grown writer. I'm out here in these publishing streets. And I felt like, you know, and that was with, you know, The Baffler, It Takes a Village, some say, where I got a check, you know, I got some, you know, spending some pocket money, and I felt like I'm a professional, you know. And that was just as recently as 2019. And I will say this about me too as well, like, I, you know, some of these stories were done at various moments in my life. I have stories that didn't make it to this collection but were finished earlier. But when I felt like I was actually now starting to submit work and then getting a paycheck for work and feeling, okay, this is something that's I can make a life around, that was the first time. And that story is, you know, it takes a village, some say, that you all, you know, was the, you know, like the capstone, the opening story of my book, and was a finalist for the 2019 Kane Prize. So I feel like, you know, it stood me in good stead in terms of making me feel like I'm grown now and I can honor my writing.
And so what is it, you know, writing that story and the success of that story that sparked the idea to develop a collection?
So there's some other stories that came before that, right? But it was that one was the one that it was interesting. Like, you know, as you know, like, this is what happens. Like, you have other stories that go out in the world. Like, I had another story that was published, but it was published in-house by like our school journal. And it's like, it doesn't really feel like you got that co-sign from the world, like the publishing world writ large, or from like, you know, like you feel you're like, you're still kind of finding your bearings. But like this one, you know, was, the story that made me feel like, okay, I should go ahead and like, you know, honor all these other stories that have come before that I feel like are ready to be part of a collection. It very much so like set me on my way. So, yeah.
Like, you know, can you talk us through the process of getting an agent, getting the deal and that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. Like, so as Donnie knows, Iowa is interesting for that because they actually have these agents kind of like, I don't know, where they're flying in on some special like kind of Avengers jet or something. Like, I don't know. But they fly in and come talk to us. And it's not until like I started teaching at other MFA programs that I realized that it's such a privilege, because they'll have agent talks with us and they'll spend time just like, you know, do a whole day where they're just trying to find the next big thing, you know. It's a weird kind of bittersweet thing because there's like, you know, the poets are there looking at you like, oh, where are our agents? And it's like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
And then you're also looking at like, you know, you have a bad agent. You know, you don't necessarily have to feel your power yet. So you're just like kind of, oh, I hope they like me. And you don't learn. You don't know that you're not supposed to, that's not where you're supposed to coming from that place yet. So, yeah, but my agent came to Iowa. And one of the reasons why I said I went with that, my agent was because I was interested in having an agent that would allow me to, well, this agent, they're headquartered in LA. And I felt like, okay, they would allow me now to kind of like spread my wings and not be like, oh, we don't do television writing. We poo-poo that, you know, because I was just like, oh, what if I want to get into a graphic novels, or if I want to do this? I just wanted to be with people who allowed me that kind of breadth of expression, right? And also, he was the only person who talked about money. And while other people were clutching their pearls and just like, well, I never. It's just, you know, we're all about the art, you know. I was like, I'm a practical African girl. I want to know how I'm about to pay my bills. What does this whole industry look like, you know? How do you kind of sustain, like, you know, practically a writing career? So he talked about money. Mm-hmm. He talked about the writing industry being overwhelmingly white. So he was very real talk, and I was here for it. So that was why I chose my agent. And then I ended up, like, you know, choosing my publisher because, you know, he wrote me this wonderful love letter to my book. And he had a vision for the book. And I was just like, that's so now when I had other, my book went to auction and there were other agents who were interested. I was like, where's that love letter though? Where's that love letter?
I literally did this. Like, you know, like people, there was another, you know, that they offered me way more money. And I was just like, but where's that vision though? Where's that vision statement? I need to kind of understand, like, you know, because it's more important. It was more important for me. The money is wonderful, but I feel that that can come, like, you know, but like, if I didn't honor the artistry, if I didn't honor and work with somebody who had a kind of a vision, a way of thinking, a real love to the book, for the book, and knew what I was trying to do and allowed me to kind of even grow even within that kind of like editorial space, then what was the point? What have I been doing all this for? Why did I leave my job in Brooklyn to move to Iowa? You know, I had never been, you know, like, what are those choices I was making were so that I could honor the creation of this art form? And like, you know, as much as I love my agent talking about money, I was just like, sometimes you have to put that practicality inside and say like, hey, it's very important for me that, you know, that all of this kind of sacrifice and this whole journey that little 9-year-old me has made till now is honored, and that I'm working with somebody who does so. And that was what I got from my Steve Woodward at Grey Wolf. You know, he just got it. You know, I was like, you never know, because you're just like, how is this Midwest guy going to get, you know, like little African me? But he was just like, go more Gonzo. He was just so, Deisha, he gave me that. He gave you Findom. He gave you the title for Rain Check at MomoCon. He was like, that whole section was like, I just went into even blurtier. Because sometimes like my problem is like, you know, or not even a problem, but like things that I'm interested in, I'm very interested in them. I'm geeky, I'm nerdy. So, but I'm just like, oh, nobody wants to hear me rant about, like, you know, Black X-Men and, you know, but he's like, do that, girl. Do it. Go in.
I love that.
Go ham. So now all of a sudden I'm adding, you know, all the stuff that I, you know, I thought I had gone Gonzo before because, you know, but I had gone to a certain point. I was just like, ah, let me just let the layperson enjoy this. But I was like, now I'm making all these Marvel references. And now, like, you know, I'm going Hadouken, the energy burst, stuff that's very much part of my own very nerd, black nerd blurtiness. But I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't necessarily privileging all that. But he was like, go hard or go home. And I was like, okay, you're doing this.
I love it. That's so important to have a team behind you who just wants you to be the most you that you can possibly be.
Absolutely. And
I think too that, like, I love the way that you talk about, you know, finding your agent, because I think in publishing, the relationship between the writer and the publishing industry is so skewed. Mm. And writers often forget that your agent works for you.
Oh, listen, we need to do a whole show on that. Like, I know it's not unique to short story writers, but I mean, that would be a public service. But anyway,
don't get me and started. That is it really was a benefit and a privilege of, you know, being at Iowa and have the agents and sometimes a couple editors come to meet with you, because it level sets that expectation of what you need to be looking for professionally. So yes, I'm glad y'all talked about money. I'm glad that your editor had you putting in, you know, all that stuff that you were maybe like a little hesitant to do, but was truly reflective of the direction that you wanted to go. Yeah,
very much so. I was, you know, I was just fortunate, because like and it's something that I pass on. You're talking about, like, you know, doing a whole business stuff. I do all these business of writing conversations with my students every single time I can, because I feel like all that stuff is cloaked in mystery, and you know, people are just so happy to be here. You're just like, oh, if I can do like some wizard, like, you know, opening behind the curtain, you can see, okay, this is not so scary. This is how things work. This is what makes this industry tick. I'm gonna do that, you know.
What's your favorite story collection or collections that you've loved recently?
So it's interesting, right? I'm only now getting a chance to start reading for pleasure again. I was just like, oh, Lord. Like, especially, like, you know, working on my own book and, you know, trying to, like, you know, you birth that book, baby, and that's a whole thing. You know how that is, Donnie. Mm-hmm. It was like, that whole year, it was like a lost year. It's just like, all I was doing was teaching and editing, and then teaching and launch and touring, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm only now, like, you know, getting back to just reading for pleasure and everything. So I know this is going to seem like fan service, but I'm totally reading Deesha's book right now. I know I'm behind the eight ball.
Thank you.
I am so behind the eight ball, but it is what it is. Like, I literally, like you know, when you're in the middle of doing your own book, you're like, okay, nothing else can, you know, you're in that space. And then COVID,
right?
You're in the middle of a global pandemic, you're just trying to live. So it's just like, so I'm really now, like, just enjoying and relishing, like, just reading again. But, you know, if you want to go back into the archives, we're talking Octavia Butler's Bloodchild, you know, we're talking ZZ Packer's Drinking Coffee Elsewhere. We're talking, you know, Diaz's Drown, like, you know, I mean, and then I have, like, all my people, like, when I think about, like, somebody who, like, made me go, like, oh, is that, can we do that? Is that really it is? Like my little feminist spidey senses were just tingling when I first read James Tiptree Jr., a.k.a., you know, Alice Sheldon, a.k.a. Racuna Sheldon, who was in her life a spy, an artist, you know, like, lived all the lives and then wrote all these stories, you know, and was universally thought to be a man for many, many years, and was having, like, long correspondence relationships with several of her speculative fiction counterparts of the day. And people were just like, oh, wow, what a robust masculine voice he has. And it was a woman all along, you know.
So wow. Because we can do anything.
Yes, we can. Exactly. Tell it. Come on. Somebody needs that word today. On today, as we just take it to church. Somebody needs that word. On today. Somebody needs to understand that. But she really kind of, like, you know, interrogated the idea about ideas of gender, and just, like, you know, wrote from this very interestingly, you know, people now can see, like, a really kind of, like, skewering, like, toxic masculinity. It was just deliciously done. All while writing beautiful sentences and writing, you know, very interesting kind of, like, futurescapes. So, yes, I'm here for all that.
So, speaking of beautiful sentences, what's the best sentence you think you've ever written?
So I'm going to tell you, like, the best sentence that, you know, like, that I've ever written is always going to be the last sentence I wrote, because I'm always very, you know, I'm like a perpetual motion machine. I want to keep moving forward and writing more and more interesting things on the page. So I don't want to rest on my laurels and just like, oh, 10 years ago, that sentence, you know, was so wonderful. And just like, I'll never top that. I don't feel that, you know, so I want to stay in the now. So I'm working on a story called All the Comforts of Home. And the last sentence, you know, the first sentence of that story goes, I've got 38 aunts called Comfort and all of them are assholes. So,
right. Because that's an African naming tradition. Like, I remember the first time I met someone named Innocence.
Yep.
So Comfort. So say that sentence again. Now that we know Comfort is a name. Go ahead.
Yep. I've got 38 aunts called Comfort and all of them are assholes. So,
oh my gosh.
I cannot wait to read that.
Yes.
Yes.
So let's do a little bit of fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest part of writing a short story is?
Starting.
Amen. Ashe.
I want to say my favorite part is also starting, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because it's all about getting your butt in the seat, right? Like, not just musing about it, not about just thinking about it, or not just like, you know, being writing adjacent, you know? Like, I've been writing adjacent too many times, you know? Like, oh, like, you know, you started that first paragraph and then you just like, you let that go for like a month, you know? But, when, you know, so, but like, is the story really starting? Is it really cooking with gas yet? And I feel like with all the comforts of home, like she's got me and I'm hooked and I'm writing. And like, it's like that's my favorite part as well. Like when I really hear that voice in my head, it's like a clarion bell. It's like magical. Like, you know, it's that cotton candy, sweet summer love. It's good. It's all good. So, and that's where I am right now with that story. So it's starting and starting. So, and really starting, you know?
Right.
Do you have any writing rituals? And also, what's the setup in your writing space? What does it look like?
Yeah, it's interesting because like when I think about my like my writing practice, right, it involves like living, right? So I think the ritual of living and being interested and engaged in the world is part of that ritual, is like the part of the process, right? Like I feel like my whole life I spend out there foraging for my fiction, right? You know, so it's just like I keep running lists of interesting, you know, character names and idiomatic expressions and weird factoids that I come across in the wild, you know. And I, you know, I don't know when it's going to be used, but I know at some point it'll make its way into my work. So that's very much part of my kind of like overall writing practice and writing rituals. And as far as my actual, like, when I'm actually on that page with, like, you know, a story like, you know, with the 38 aunts named Comfort, I can't say that I'm very fussy. Like, you know, it just involves me sitting down, you know, like it changes sometimes. Like I had one particular story which had a strong hip hop beat to it, you know, so I would play hip hop music to kind of stay in that kind of rhythm and that kind of musicality. But it changes from story to story, you know, like a story like The Devil is a Liar, right? Did I listen to, you know, gospel music at one point? Yes. Did I do that every time? No. So it would change depending on like the needs of that, you know, what would get me in that space that day. And in terms of my writing setup, like, you know, I've got, it's a mixture. Like I've got like a bronze sculpture of a Cameroonian woman. She's like bare-breasted with a Harvard basket on her back, but I got her decked out in pearls looking flossy. So it's like, you know, so like this speaks to my themes. Like, you know, I love to see women like, you know, that intersectional identity of Black womanhood. So she's flossy but hardworking and, like, you know, and native in that kind of way. And I've got like little hip hop affirmations like, every day I'm hustling and I'm bossy, you know. And then I also have, like, you know, like in this place of honor, I've got an image of my grandmother, Paulina Loe Nana. They called her big, and she was big in personality, big in stature. And she's just like has this huge dynastic clan. But she had to dream big, you know, very early on, and put my mother in school at a time when, you know, education was not universal. It was not like accessible to young girls. And that kind of foresight and that vision and her, you know, the kind of joyousness she had in life and the kind of, you know, foresight to make sure that all her girl children were educated, because she had like mainly girl children, and people were saying, oh, that's so sad, you know. That actually, you know, is why I'm here today. So she's there and she looks at me and she smiles. So. Mm.
Nana, thank you so much. Just, you know, for this generous conversation. Fun, so much fun talking with you. It's like part two of Miami, but virtual. And thank you for your collection, which is fun to read, but it's also so bold. And that's just really inspiring to me as a writer. And it was just such a delight to read. So thank you so much.
Deesha, Donnie, thank you so much for having me on this platform. You guys are amazing, you know, conversations partners, and I really felt incredibly at home and thankful to talk to with, you know, two authors who are making this amazing space for literature in the world and also putting out great literature in the world themselves. I appreciate this.
Aww.
Thank you.
Aww, thank you so much. And we will get together again, whether in Miami or some other place.
Amen to that. I'll be there for Miami 2.0, you know.
Well, friends, we've reached the end of Ursa Season 1. This has been a wonderful experience. We've learned so much about some amazing writers and stories, the craft of writing and storytelling, and about living a creative life. It's been inspiring and thrilling, and even more so to hear from everybody who's joined us on this journey.
We are so thankful for all of your support for this show. We'll be back very soon, and we're so excited to keep going with more stories and conversations in Season 2 and beyond.
As always, if you'd like to support our work, become an Ursa member by going to ursastory.com/join. You'll help us keep producing this show and doing it on our terms. Until next time,